Now, the expert team we have assembled to lead this critical session starts with Yelena, who I introduced following her performance in the previous panel. She joins again, appropriate because she's part of the conceptual framework team. To Yelena's right is Anne McGeekin, technical principal at the ISB. Anne, I think she's somebody who, in conceptual framework terms, must be a supporter of recycling because she has recycled herself to the ISB for, I think, the second time. Having been with us for a number of years, she left to take up a teaching position at the University of Aberdeen and rejoined in time to first help finish the conceptual framework project and then something in her personality said, I really have to be the one to draft IFRS 17. So Anne brings a wealth of experience to this project. And to Anne's right is Rachel Nubley, who is an oasis of calm in a very busy organization. Rachel was at the same time a key member of the conceptual framework team, especially as we were finalizing it, and then also took on, before that role finished, director role for the wide range of projects that comes up under better communication. So Rachel has had a busy couple of years and yet has maintained her calm throughout. So we welcome this panel drawn from the CF team to give us an overview of what we're then going to be putting in practice in about an hour's time. Anne, over to you.
Thanks, Mary. We're going to spend about 40 minutes, maybe 45 minutes, running through the requirements of the new conceptual framework. And then at the end, we're very happy to answer questions. So please input your questions onto Slido. I hope you all know how to do that by now. If you put in lots of questions, we will answer as many as we can get through in the time. So we're going to give you an overview of the 2018 conceptual framework, looking at each section in turn, giving you a high-level view of what we've included in there. And as I say, at the end, we will leave time for you to ask questions or input comments. It'd be very interesting to see what you think about our new framework. So first, what is the conceptual framework? Well, Tom and Andrew before lunch were talking about what a conceptual framework is, the various roles it might play. The board decided that what it wanted out of a conceptual framework was something that would be of practical help for the board in making standard setting decisions. That means that we got some feedback that was critical of the conceptual framework as we were developing it, of our proposals, that it wasn't sufficiently aspirational, that it didn't set sort of a holy grail of what financial reporting should be. The board wanted something, as I say, that it could use. It didn't want a highly theoretical, aspirational document of what financial reporting might be in an ideal world. So the focus was on setting up a framework that would be useful for the board in developing standards. As a corollary, we expect it will also be useful for preparers when they need to develop accounting policies. And we think it'll be helpful for everybody to understand and interpret the standards that we develop using this framework, because the principles should be clearly aligned with the conceptual framework or a clear explanation of why we've departed if the board does depart. For the first time in a conceptual framework, we have a comprehensive set of concepts. So this framework, one of the most important things that we did with this framework was fill in gaps that were there from the previous framework. And we've tried hard to get the right balance between high-level concepts and sufficient detail so that when the board does come to make standard-level decisions, there's enough in the framework that will allow it that will be helpful for it in making those decisions. So what have we done? So the conceptual framework that existed before this one, before 2018, was largely written in 1989, so a long time ago. It had been revised in 2010 as part of a joint project with the FASB. But it was incomplete, our framework. It didn't have anything on derecognition. It had some discussion of measurement, but it listed measurement bases that are not used in IFRS standards, and it didn't tell you how you might choose between them, even if you did want to use them. It didn't include anything on profit or loss or other comprehensive income. So we've filled in those gaps, so we've got a comprehensive set of principles. It's also clear that since 1989, thinking in terms of financial reporting has moved on. And so we've updated the definitions of an asset and a liability, and guidance supporting those definitions, and also the recognition criteria. And one of the things that I think will become clear as we go through this overview is that the conceptual framework is now much more of a unified whole. It starts with an objective and then qualitative characteristics, and then it uses that objective and those qualitative characteristics as the bedrock for the rest of the framework in setting up how you establish concepts and a framework for making decisions based on the objective and the qualitative characteristics. Sometimes we are criticized because it seems like the updating of the framework could be perceived as being there just to justify decisions that we've made in recent standards. But as I think Tom was saying this morning, it's very much, there's a flow to and from standard setting into the conceptual framework, and then from the conceptual framework back into standard setting. It's not surprising that we have come up with, or we have the same thinking in this conceptual framework as is reflected in recent standards. I mean, it would be very bizarre if we'd set a set of standards recently and then we issued a conceptual framework that was totally different. I mean, that would be very odd. So the updates in this framework, you will see the same thinking already reflected in our recent standards. As I said, the conceptual framework was most recently revised in 2010 as part of a joint project with the FASB, and it is clear from feedback that we've had since then that some of the changes we made have led to confusion, in particular in the way that we view stewardship, prudence, substance over form, and measurement and certainty. And so what we've done in this revision is we've left the chapters that were revised in 2010, so chapters 1 and 2 as they are now, we've left them substantially the same because we didn't want to create diversity unnecessarily, and we had just recently been through a very thorough due process on those chapters. But we have clarified where it's become clear to us that what we did in 2010 has been misunderstood. So there's clarification to those chapters. So in terms of the effects of the 2018 revision, from the board's point of view, they are, and the IFRS Interpretations Committee's point of view, they are going to start using the 2018 conceptual framework immediately. But it's important to note that the framework it's not a standard, and it does not override standards. And also importantly, the board has said very clearly that if it does identify an inconsistency between an existing standard and the new conceptual framework, that of itself is not going to be a reason for the board to start revising that standard. They would only revise a standard if it had been, you know, if there were problems in practice, if it went through the due process of an agenda consultation, it's not going to be an automatic trigger for revising an existing standard just because maybe it's demonstrated that it's no longer consistent with the framework. And we did look at whether we thought there would be inconsistencies, and there were only very limited circumstances where we thought that there were inconsistencies. From a preparer point of view, they have until the 1st of January 2020 before they need to use the new framework if they're developing their own accounting policies. We've also, the board had a paper that set out exactly in what circumstances preparers would be using the conceptual framework in terms of the IAS 8 hierarchy. That was a question that came in this morning. And so in the July board meeting, the board looked at a paper that explains when preparers need to use the conceptual framework. So that might be of interest to you as well to look at. Okay, so moving on to the first two chapters. So these were the chapters that were issued in 2010 and have been revised to make some ideas clear, more clear, what the board was thinking. So we start with the objective of general purpose financial reporting, which is to provide financial information that's useful to primary users of financial reports in making decisions about providing resources to the entity. And that has not changed. That is the same objective as was in the 2010 conceptual framework. What we have done is we've clarified the role of stewardship within that objective. So, and we've done that in a number of ways. Firstly, we've used the term stewardship in the conceptual framework, which wasn't there in the 2010 version. We've enhanced its prominence. We were criticized because people thought we'd removed the idea of stewardship in the revisions that were made in 2010. And that's not the case. The board didn't remove the idea of stewardship. This idea about information about how efficiently and effectively management discharges its responsibilities was still there in the framework, but it was hidden relatively. We have now made it more prominent. And as part of doing that, we've clarified that the decisions that we are thinking about when we're thinking about useful information are to buy and hold or sell investments or to provide and settle loans, but it's also to vote and influence management while you have an investment in the entity. So we've clarified that that's part of the decision making that's within the scope of what we're providing information for. We then say that you need users of financial statements are looking to assess two things: the prospects for future net cash inflows and to assess management's stewardship of the entity's resources. And importantly, to make both of those two assessments, you need both of the sets of information at the bottom of the slide. So you need information about economic resources, claims and changes in them, and information about how efficiently and effectively management has discharged its responsibilities. And it isn't that you need one set of information for one assessment and the other set of information for the other assessment. Both assessments need both types of information. So we hope that that helps put stewardship, you know, back in context in an appropriate way in the framework. We have also, in the framework, it talks about the primary users of financial reporting, of financial reports, and this hasn't changed since 2010. So it's existing and potential investors, lenders, and other creditors. Some feedback we got said that we should broaden that group and include stakeholders such as employees or customers. Other feedback we got was that we should narrow that group so that it should be focused on like the most residual, the holders of the most residual set of equity. We think we're broadly in the right place, somewhere between the two. So we've left it unchanged. We say that you know, we need to focus on the common information needs of these groups, because different types of users do want different information, but there's a core of information that everybody wants. Preparers of financial reports can always include additional information if they think that that's useful for a particular subset of primary users. Importantly, it is focused, though, on this set of primary users, and we're not trying to produce financial information that is necessary for example, regulators or other people who have their own way of getting information. If a party can get hold of private information from an entity, then they don't need to go to general purpose financial statements, financial reports for that information. So the point about general purpose financial reporting is it's providing information to those who don't have access to private information. Qualitative characteristics, again, as before, we've got relevance and faithful representation. Faithful representation has turned out, I think, understandably, to be a concept that is quite difficult to grasp. Before 2010, it was relevance and reliability, and people seemed to have, or thought they had, a much more intuitive sense of what that's about. And on the next slide, I'll explain what we've done with the idea of faithful representation to try and enhance people's understanding of faithful representation. Relevance is, can the information, is it capable of making a difference to decision made by users? Faithful representation is about the way that the elements and the transaction is represented. Is that complete, neutral, and free from error? We also have enhancing qualitative characteristics as before, and we have the cost constraint, so that, you know, every decision about financial reporting, you have to weigh up the benefits and the costs. So faithful representation did prove to be, you know, a tricky concept, and understandably. So the first thing that we've done in this revision is, so prudence is an idea that was in the framework before 2010. It was taken out of the 2010 framework, the word, but this idea of exercising caution under conditions of uncertainty was still there. What many people think of when they hear the term prudence is they think about an asymmetric recognition or measurement threshold, saying that you need to be more careful about assets and income than about liabilities and losses. We're saying that's not what we mean by prudence. Prudence is exercise of caution under conditions of uncertainty, and that applies equally to assets, liabilities, income, and expenses. However, it is possible that in coming to decisions about what provides useful information, that might result in asymmetric treatment at a standards level. And it's certainly true that, you know, many of our standards include or result in an asymmetric treatment of assets and income versus liabilities and expenses. Going forward, we think that might continue to happen, but because that's what we think gives useful information, and that asymmetric treatment is not there as a sort of systematic objective that we're trying to aim for. We talk more clearly about uncertainty of different types in the framework, but in particular measurement uncertainty. So it was clear from our feedback that many people were thinking that reliability was the same as a sort of lack of measurement uncertainty. And we want faithful representation to be a broader notion, but it does include this idea of measurement uncertainty. Now, almost all amounts in a set of financial statements include some measurement uncertainty. I mean, possibly cash at the bank doesn't, but almost every other number includes some sort of estimation process. And having an estimation process that results in measurement uncertainty is a normal part of preparing financial statements and definitely does not prevent the information resulting information from being useful. However, there may be occasions where the level of measurement uncertainty is so high that it does affect whether a sufficiently faithful representation can be given. And we've explained that in our discussion of the qualitative characteristic of faithful representation, and we refer to it in the chapters on recognition and measurement, which Rachel will talk about soon. We also reinstated the words about substance over form and gave an explanation of what we meant by substance over form in this revision. And then finally, to come back to, so people like the idea of the trade-off between relevance and reliability, that notion that you can't always get everything that you want out of bits of information. You have to balance the information you get, the characteristics of that information. And this idea of balancing relevance and reliability was something that many people found, intuitive to understand and helpful. And we agree that there is this balance, and we phrase it in terms of it's a balance between relevance and faithful representation, and then faithful representation includes the notion of measurement uncertainty. So we hope by doing this we'll have explained to people that that idea that they've always had is still there and is still useful. I am now going to hand over to Rachel.
Thank you very much, Anne. What we'll do now is take a look at what the conceptual framework now says about the elements of financial statements and also about recognition. The old conceptual framework defined an asset as a resource controlled by the entity that's arisen as a result of past events and from which future economic benefits are expected to flow. The revised definition of an asset is up on the slide. We've made three main changes to that definition as a result of the changes to the conceptual framework. Firstly, the old definition blurred the distinction between the resource and the resulting flow of economic benefits that was expected to flow from the asset or liability. The revised definition tries to focus much more clearly on the idea that what you need to look at is the economic resource rather than the flow that would result from that economic resource. And we also define economic resources in terms of rights. Now, many have seen this as quite a significant change to the way in which we look at assets, to define them in terms of rights. However, I think really it isn't such a significant change. I think it probably reflects the way in which the board has looked at assets for quite a significant period of time now. If you look at the way that the new leasing standard deals with leases and right-of-use assets, that's very much focused upon rights, and I think the new definition reflects that thinking that was already embedded in the board's thinking when it developed the leasing standard. The second change that I'd like to highlight here is that the revised definition no longer includes a reference to expected flows of economic benefits. This is because some had interpreted expected as a probability threshold, meaning that unless the probability of an inflow of economic benefits exceeded a certain probability, you would not have an asset existing. If this interpretation were applied, items that are clearly assets, for example, out-of-the-money options, would not meet the definition of an asset. So to avoid this confusion, the reference to expected within the definition of an asset has been removed, and the revised definition simply refers to the potential that a right has to produce economic benefits. The final change, I think, is largely a structural change, which is that we have moved the definition of an economic resource from the definition of an asset itself and into a subsidiary definition. Two reasons for doing that. Firstly, it helps us focus on the economic resource rather than the ultimate flow, so it helps with the first point I was talking about. And then secondly, it ends up with what I think is a clearer and more concise definition of an asset. The changes that we've made to the definition of a liability largely mirror the changes that we've made to the definition of an asset. The focus here is on the entity's obligation rather than the outflow of economic benefits. And again, the reference to expected has been removed from the definition. I think where we've made some important changes to the definition of a liability is around the guidance accompanying the definition. And it's clarified a number of important points about the definition of a liability. Firstly, it makes it clear that a liability, that an obligation doesn't have to be unconditional for a liability to exist. An obligation may arise in some situations where an entity has no practical ability to avoid the transfer. And we hope that this will actually help with some of the difficult areas around liabilities that the board has been struggling with over a number of years. And in particular, I'm thinking about the issues we've had to address around levies, where liabilities seem to be being recognised at a later stage than many people felt comfortable with. Secondly, the guidance supporting the definition of a liability provides guidance to help entities identify when an obligation arises. And it states an obligation has arisen when an entity has received a benefit or taken an action, and as a result of that receiving that benefit or taking that action, it will have to transfer an economic resource that it would not otherwise have had to do so. So we hope, again, it helps with this identification of when a liability actually arises. When we come onto the case studies later on today, hopefully some of this guidance around the definition of a liability will help you with some of the tricky questions you have around contingent and variable consideration. So having looked at the changes that we've made to the definition of an asset and liability, let's have a look at the revised recognition criteria. The old recognition criteria had three criteria in there. Firstly, the asset or the thing that we wanted to recognise would have to meet the definition of an element. And that's unchanged in the revised conceptual framework. We say for you to be able to recognise something, it must meet the definition. The second two criteria in the old framework were that it must be probable that there would be an inflow or outflow of economic benefits. And then it would be necessary that you could measure any resulting asset or liability reliably. Now, these old recognition criteria caused a number of problems in practice. The reference to probability of inflows or outflows were interpreted by some as preventing the recognition of assets or liabilities that only have a low probability of an inflow or outflow of economic benefits. The reference to reliability was also interpreted by some as preventing the recognition of some items, such as, for example, derivatives, that are subject to high measurement uncertainty. It's clear that in some cases, recognizing items that have a low probability of an inflow or outflow or has significantly high measurement uncertainty would provide useful information to users of financial statements. As a result, we've ended up in situations where the board has largely ignored those recognition criteria in developing standards. For example, the standards on financial instruments largely ignore those recognition criteria. So when developing the new recognition criteria, what we tried to do was focus on situations where recognition would provide useful information to users of financial statements. And so assets and liabilities will get recognized in situations where recognition will provide useful information. As a result, we've focused on the qualitative characteristics of useful information. And we describe factors to consider in determining whether those characteristics are met. The probability of an inflow or outflow of economic benefits and measurement uncertainty, or reliability in the old speak of the conceptual framework, still have a role to play in deciding whether an asset or liability is recognized. But we've also added some additional criteria in there that we need to think about. So, for example, existence uncertainty clearly has a role to play in determining whether recognition of an asset or liability would provide useful information. If there is uncertainty around the existence of an asset or liability, recognition may not provide relevant information. I've already mentioned measurement uncertainty, but we also have recognition inconsistency or accounting mismatches as another factor to think about when deciding on recognition. If you have assets and liabilities that are linked in some way, then if you recognize one of the assets and you do not recognize another asset or a related liability, then you can end up with an accounting mismatch either in the balance sheet or in the statement of financial performance, which may not provide a faithful representation of the financial position or financial performance of the entity. The other thing to think about when thinking about recognition is about any resulting income expenses or changes in equity that arise out of either a decision to recognize or a decision not to recognize a particular asset and liability. So you could have a situation where not recognizing an asset or liability would result in an income or expense, and the question is whether that income or expense provides a faithful representation of the performance of the entity in the period in which that income or expense was or was not recognized. In developing the recognition criteria, the board noted that in many cases, it's not going to be a single one of these factors that will drive you to make a decision to recognize or not to recognize an asset or liability. It is likely to be a combination of factors that would lead you to a decision not to recognize something. So, for example, if you had a situation where you had an asset that was perhaps subject to some existence uncertainty, was perhaps subject to a low probability of an inflow or outflow, and in addition, significant measurement uncertainty, you might at that stage start to think, well, perhaps the combination of those factors would lead you to a decision not to recognize and perhaps find other ways of providing information about that asset or liability, for example, through disclosure. We have on here as well a thing to think about, which is the cost constraint. We mention it explicitly in relation to recognition, but of course the cost constraint is pervasive throughout financial reporting, and we need to think of it whenever we're thinking about any decisions in standard setting. Moving on, just to look briefly at the other elements of the financial statements, equity, income, and expenses. We've made only limited changes to each of these definitions. In particular, equity continues to be defined as a residual interest. In developing the revised conceptual framework, the board deliberately decided not to address questions about the distinctions between liability and equity, and is instead seeking to address those questions as part of the financial instruments with the characteristics of equity project. Now, depending upon the outcome of that project, and of course the discussion paper is out for comment at the moment, we may need to revise the conceptual framework, but we will have to wait and see as to what happens with the FICE project to decide if and when revisions to the conceptual framework are needed. The changes to the definition of income and expenses are largely consequential changes made as a result of the changes to the definitions of assets and liabilities. I think one really important point to note about this, though, is that although we define income and expenses in terms of changes in assets and liabilities, it's not because the board thinks that information about assets and liabilities is more important than information about income and expenses. We basically think it's easier to define assets and liabilities first because assets and liabilities are really based upon real-world economic phenomena, that is, economic resources and claims. And therefore, we've discovered over the years it's easier to define the assets and liabilities first. However, information about assets and liabilities and income and expenses are useful to users. Neither is more important than the other, and the conceptual framework makes that point in a number of places throughout the document. So we've briefly talked about the definitions of the elements, and we've talked about the recognition criteria. So we've decided we have something that meets the definition of an asset or a liability, and then we've decided that we want to recognize that. The next step that we have to take is to decide how that item will be measured. As Anne said, the old conceptual framework provided very little guidance on measurement. It basically listed out a number of different measurement bases, but provided no guidance whatsoever on the factors to consider in deciding when to use a particular measurement basis. And so for the first time, we have a chapter in the conceptual framework that provides what we hope is going to be useful guidance to the board and others in looking at deciding which measurement basis to use. The first thing I think to note is that the conceptual framework envisages a mixed measurement model. Although we had a handful of stakeholders who advocated the use of a single measurement basis, or perhaps a default measurement basis, for all assets and liabilities, typically things like fair value or current cost was mentioned as that default or required measurement basis, most of our stakeholders expressed the view that consideration of what is useful to users of financial information and the cost constraint is likely to result in the selection of different measurement bases for different types of assets and liabilities. So as a result, you will see that it is a mixed measurement model in the conceptual framework. To help the board to decide which measurement basis to select, the chapter on measurement first describes the different measurement bases and the information they provide. The theory behind that is that the board will be able to compare the information needs of the users of financial statements with the information provided by the different measurement bases and come up with the one that best fits the needs of the users of the financial information. There is, within the conceptual framework, a series of tables that describes in detail the information provided in both the statement of financial position and the statements of financial performance by the different measurement bases. And we hope that that's going to prove really useful to the board and others in selecting particular measurement bases. We describe two different families of measurement bases within the conceptual framework, starting off with historical cost, which includes the amortized cost for financial assets and financial liabilities. The second family of measurement bases is current value. Historical cost provides information about the transaction or events that gave rise to the asset or liability and can be useful in providing information about margins. Current value is updated to reflect conditions at the measurement date and as such provides information about changes in prices and other factors. The conceptual framework describes three different types of current value. We have fair value, which reflects a market participant point of view and market participant assumptions. We have value in use for assets and fulfillment value for liabilities, which reflect entity-specific assumptions. And then we have current cost, which is a current entry value. And we thought it was important to include an entry value in addition to those exit values there. So those are the measurement bases described in the conceptual framework. Having described the measurement bases, we then go on to discuss factors to consider in selecting a measurement basis. And once again, as we did with the recognition criteria, we go back to what's going to be useful to the users of financial statements, and we look at the qualitative characteristics of useful information, in particular relevance and faithful representation. The characteristics of an asset or a liability, for example, its variability in its cash flows or its sensitivity to market factors, can affect the relevance of the information provided by a particular measurement basis. For example, derivative financial instruments are often sensitive to market risks, which makes amortized cost unsuitable as a measurement basis for these types of financial asset or liability. The way in which an asset or liability contributes to cash flows can also affect the relevance of the information provided in the financial statements or by a particular measurement basis. For example, if you have an asset that can generate cash flows directly, perhaps through sale, and is largely independent of the other resources of the entity, and so it can generate those cash flows largely independently of the other resources of the entity, then it's likely that a current value will provide the most useful information. So, for example, fair value may provide useful information about many financial instruments which can generate economic returns independently of the other resources of the entity. However, if you have a situation where you have an asset that is used in combination with other resources and generates cash flows indirectly, so, for example, property, plant, and equipment, it doesn't generate cash flows directly, it generates them in combination with other resources of the entity. In those sorts of situations, then something like a historical cost may provide more useful information than a current value and would possibly provide information about margins, which is useful on a historical cost basis. So So that sort of covers the idea of relevance. Moving on to faithful representation, there are a couple of things we need to think about. Firstly, measurement uncertainty. The level of measurement uncertainty associated with a particular measurement basis can affect whether it provides a faithful representation of the financial position or financial performance of the entity, and so is one of the factors that would need to be considered in selecting a measurement basis. Similarly, measurement inconsistency can affect faithful representation. So if you have an asset or a liability measured on one basis, perhaps the current value, and you have a linked asset or liability measured on a different basis, for example, historic cost, then you end up with a measurement inconsistency, which again may not faithfully represent the position or the performance of the reporting entity. Another thing to note is that we need to think carefully about the information that is provided in both the statement of financial position and the statement of financial performance by the selection of a particular measurement basis. Thinking about the balance sheet in isolation or the statement of performance in isolation is unlikely to result in a good measurement selection. We also look briefly at the enhancing qualitative characteristics and the cost constraints and discuss how those could also affect the selection of a particular measurement basis. Moving on to another new chapter in the conceptual framework, and this is something that's very close to my heart with the work that I do on primary financial statements and disclosure initiative, and that's the chapter dealing with presentation and disclosure. We start off by providing some very high-level principles for the board to use when developing presentation and disclosure requirements. In our disclosure initiative project, we're building on these high-level principles to develop more detailed guidance for the board to use when developing and drafting disclosure objectives and requirements. We're planning to test this new guidance as part of our targeted standards-level review of disclosures, and with the hope that it will result in more effective disclosure requirements in the future. One of the areas that the board has struggled with and found quite difficult over the years are questions around whether income and expenses should be reported outside profit or loss in other comprehensive income, and whether income and expenses that are reported in other comprehensive income should subsequently be recycled into profit or loss. Decisions about whether to use OFCI and whether to recycle have been made for different and, to be honest, not always consistent reasons over the years. The new conceptual framework aims to provide the board with some high-level guidance that it can use on a consistent basis to decide whether to permit or require income or expenses to be reported in OCI. In order to provide guidance on the use of OCI, the board first thought about the role of the statement of profit or loss. Users have consistently told us that information included in the statement of profit or loss is their primary, although of course not their only, source of information about financial performance. Given this primacy of profit or loss, the board concluded that in principle all income and expenses should be included in that statement. Presenting income and expenses outside profit or loss should only happen in exceptional circumstances and should be rare. The circumstances where it might be acceptable to provide information outside profit or loss in other comprehensive income would be when it would result in more relevant information for users or a more faithful representation of the entity's financial performance. In principle, items of income and expense should be included in OCI should be recycled. Again, this goes back to the idea of the primacy of profit or loss. If profit or loss is primary, income and expenses shouldn't bypass profit or loss completely. The only exception to this notion of income and expenses being included in OCI being recycled is if there is no basis for the recycling that would result in relevant information or a faithful representation of the financial performance for the period in which the recycling occurs. One final point to note, the option to use OCI is only available to the board. Preparers cannot decide to use OCI themselves and cannot decide on recycling themselves. This is consistent with the current position where IS1 makes it clear that the use of OCI in recycling is reserved for the board. With that, I will pause and open up for questions.
Yes. Well, we've got a number of questions. Quite a few of them about the status of the conceptual frameworks. Perhaps I'll start with one of them. So if the standard setting is to be guided by the conceptual framework, why does it say that nothing in the conceptual framework overrides any requirement in the standard?
I think this goes back to the idea that the conceptual framework really provides a framework of thinking for the board in order to come to decisions in the standard setting process. And often there are lots of different factors that need to be balanced in coming to a decision. There are often no black and white answers arriving from the conceptual framework. So, for example, the board may have gone through an assessment of cost-benefit analysis. It may have gone through an assessment of what is likely to provide the most useful information, and that assessment will have been based upon outreach with users. So the board will have done a lot of good thinking behind the standards, and allowing people to override the standards by the reference to the conceptual framework, I think, runs the risk of those preparers who are doing that ignoring all of the information that the board had when it was actually setting those particular standards and requirements. So I think that's what's behind this notion of the standards have primacy, the conceptual framework is there as backup.
Now, another question, and this is probably coming out of our slide on recognition that talked about the need to think about existence uncertainty in recognition. And the question is, if a right is present, how can existence be uncertain? Why are we thinking about it?
There are some situations where perhaps existence uncertainty does arise. Admittedly, I think they're relatively unusual situations. One of the ones where the board has done a lot of thinking over are lawsuits, for example, where it may be uncertain whether a liability exists until, for example, the court has ruled on a particular position to say, yes, there is a breach of law here, and therefore there is a liability to remedy that breach in some way. And so those sorts of situations where there is a level of uncertainty about the existence of a right or an obligation are the sorts of things we're talking about with existence uncertainty.
And just sort of responding directly to that question, if there were a present right, there wouldn't be existence uncertainty. That you'd have existence uncertainty only if you weren't sure whether or not there was a present right.
Well, Anne just asked me a minute ago, do we have any questions on prudence? Yes, we do now.
You said that.
So, it came up. So please clarify, what is meant by asymmetrical requirements in some standards with reference to prudence?
Well, for example, if you look at IS 37, it says that you recognize contingent liabilities if it's more likely than not, or liabilities if it's more likely than not, there'll be an outflow. But for contingent assets, you have to be virtually certain of an inflow. So that's just one example, and there are others.
Thank you. Now, another question is, we're getting more and more, sorry, I lost the one that was here just. Right, so one question is, how often is the conceptual framework going to be revised? I know we keep saying that new issues are coming up.
There is no sort of set timetable for revision of the conceptual framework. What we have said is that as we work with the conceptual framework, as new accounting issues arise, then there may be situations in which we would look to revise the conceptual framework. The work that we're doing on the financial instruments with the characteristics of equity project, I think, is one example of a situation where ongoing work might suggest that we need to make some changes to the conceptual framework. What I would say is that we've got a really difficult balancing act to maintain with revisions to the conceptual framework. Clearly, we don't want to be revising the conceptual framework every 5 minutes in response to particular individual standard-setting problems, because that would undermine the whole principle of having a framework in the first place to provide us with a consistent basis for standard-setting decisions. However, there are undoubtedly situations where we're going to need to revise. We know that the conceptual framework isn't perfect. We know that there are areas where we would like to do more thinking. And so as that thinking evolves, we will look at whether to revise, but it's going to be a difficult balancing thing for the board to weigh up.
Now, a question about the uses of financial reporting. So, as we mentioned, they include investors, lenders, and other creditors. Now, primary users of financial reporting, majority control shareholders and minority shareholders may have conflicting information needs. How to decide whose needs are a priority?
Well, what we say in the conceptual framework is we're going to focus on the common information needs. So we would be looking at sort of information that will be useful to all the primary users. In specific circumstances, we might think about information specific to one group rather than another, but usually it'll be looking at common information needs. And also, I mean, entities are always free to give additional information if they think in their specific circumstances that it's, you know, it'd be helpful to give extra information that's particularly useful to a subgroup of the primary users, then they are free to do that.
Now, one more question. Can a provision be recognized progressively? It looks possible under the framework, but some think that progressive provision is not allowed under IAS 37.
I think one thing to point out, of course, is that going back to the first question we had, is that the framework doesn't override any requirements of a particular standard. So you need to look at a particular standard and say, does that have requirements for this particular situation? And if it does have requirements for that particular situation, then you must follow the standard, not the conceptual framework. I think, having said that, I think the changes that we have made to the guidance surrounding the definition of a liability does envisage the earlier recognition of liabilities in certain circumstances. But, of course, we have very limited situations in which liabilities are not actually covered by existing standards, and you need to have a look at those to follow the requirements in those areas.
Right. Is there? I want to leave time for evaluations and getting people moving for the 2:30 start. Is there one more that you're desperate to ask and answer? If not, because I know they're clustering.
Well, there is an interesting question. I'm not sure Anne and Rachel will appreciate me asking it, but the question is, if you could change one thing in the conceptual framework, what would it be?
I've had a chance to think about this, so I'll answer while Rachel thinks. Actually, I'd like to pick two. One is about extra discussion. I personally, this is absolutely my personal view, and the board members may have completely different views. I would like to see more discussion about entry and exit values in the measurement chapter and the different information that you get coming out of entry and exit values. So that's sort of structural additional stuff. And then an even more personal view that reflects my UK background. Contrary to what Mary said in her introduction, I would love to have a principle of not recycling rather than recycling, but that's just me.
I think my one, and again, very personal view, is I never really understood why understandability is an enhancing qualitative characteristic rather than a fundamental characteristic. If something's not understandable, why are we doing it? But again, very personal view.
Okay. Well, let me first ask you to join me in thanking this expert team. For what I hope will be a very useful setup for the session we're about to do.